Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes.
You're listening to the Innovators Podcast with Tom Kennedy, unpacking the stories of industry leaders in search of the tools, tips, and tricks that make them who they are today.
Welcome to episode 3 of The Innovators. I firstly want to apologize for it being a week late. As you will hear in the episode, there were a few recording issues. This was actually recorded after the fact in the Daily Maverick offices using a sort of special mobile unit. And unfortunately, I put it on the desk, not knowing that every time we sort of shifted our weight, it would make a sort of weird knocking noise. So we've done our best to try and sort of buffer and clean the audio so it's as listenable as possible. But every now and again, you might hear a little sort of knocking noise. I do apologize for that. So I hope you can focus on the content, which I personally think is amazing. I think Steely had a lot of really sort of amazing stuff to share about what went on behind the scenes with the Gupta leaks, which I hope you're all familiar with now. This is a follow-on from episode 2, so if you haven't listened to episode 2, which was the in-depth interview with Steely, who is the CEO of the Daily Maverick, I really recommend you go give it a listen. It's a great piece on media publishing and running an online business in South Africa today. So give it a listen. But for this episode, the Gupta Leak Special, as it's being named by me, is we sort of focus on what went on behind the scenes. There's a lot about protecting sources, how they dealt with the data, how they made sure the data was secure, how they accessed it, shared it, and sort of processed it. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff here. It was a very Snowden-esque sort of scenario, so it's very interesting to see how they had to handle that behind the scenes. I hope you guys enjoy it. I will be releasing episode 4 next week to make up for the lost time. So that will be with Professor Timothy Noakes. It's a really insightful episode where we look at diet, nutrition, and a whole bunch of amazing stuff. So be sure to click subscribe. And as always, show notes are available at theinnovators.co. And you can connect with me across pretty much every platform available at T. Kennedy SA. I'm always open to suggestions, feedback, questions, and guest suggestions. So give me a shout. I will do my best to respond. For now, I hope you guys enjoy episode 3, the Gupta Leak Special. Peace, I'm out. So how did the Gupta leaks actually come about, and how did the Daily Maverick get so sort of intertwined in the leak and bringing it to the sort of forefront?
In touch with an activist, who he thought he'd be able to trust with the information, the source documents, and advice with who to hand it over to. Obviously, a media outlet would have been one of the best places to do that. Our editor was kind of offered the information, which we recognized at the time was going to be game changing. So we jumped at the opportunity to get stuck into it with the project, but came with a hell of a lot of just new challenges and planning that you need to you don't normally need to take into account in your day-to-day sort of running of a news operation. The secrecy, the safety of the source, the having to have meetings, taking digital security and physical security up an extra level, having meetings in parks, leaving phones,
did it actually go that far? So you're living that sort of Snowden lifestyle.
Yeah, it was, for those 2 months where we had the information and we were the only guys who had the information, the target on our backs was obviously quite big. We had to take every precaution because if the people knew that we had this information, we were the only ones who had the information, the incentive for them to stop us getting it out would have been great. Now that multiple publications have the information, that's obviously reduced significantly. But at the time, it was really next level cloak and dagger stuff that we had to, we had to undertake to ensure our own safety and that of the source.
Okay, and then you've reported on the size of the amount of data that you have. Like, how just how big is the sort of amount of files and data that you need to actually process and sort of go through?
Well, when we started working on it, was 200,000 emails that we managed to get sort of cleaned up and available to use. That has since grown to about 500,000 emails, and in total a terabyte of data, of files, contents of a hard drive. So yeah, it's a lot. I mean, if you think of how many Word documents and PDFs can go into a terabyte of data, and how many emails, it's a lot. And it's, you know, there's just so much to search. It's not like you're going, oh, we'll just follow this one corrupt person all the way through these documents. It's multiple corrupt relationships and multiple corrupt entities. So, you know, the permutations of what you can follow around, plus all the various different elements of metadata on each of those documents.
And then also like cross-referencing with public databases and finding those sort of correlations that exist that might not be so obvious in the very beginning. So
yeah, it's a huge it would take a team of 20 investigators at least a year to kind of go through all this stuff in the level that you'd want to, but you know, you don't really have that luxury of time, so you kind of need to plan, you know, what are the hardest hitting stories you can start with? What are the stories that the Amma Bongani team have been chasing for years, but, you know, couldn't fill in the pieces?
You know, so was that the first objective? Let's corroborate what we've already thought or sort of been given insinuations has occurred.
And yeah, you know, our editor, when he got it, it wasn't even a... we didn't think twice about reaching out to the Amma Bongani guys to say, we need you to work on this with us. We don't have the skills and the history to be able to do this alone. And we would do an injustice to the investigation if it didn't involve them. So we were kind of, especially in the beginning, led by, you know, what their feeling was around the main stories. Each of their journals had been investigating different elements of this corrupt empire, so they were running off on that, and then we were just kind of like fitting in and going on, okay, well, then our new investigators we'd hired for the Scorpio unit had also been working on some stuff in the past. The emails were showing up some new elements that we could then cover on that basis, sort of lower hanging fruit. And yeah, as we go and continue to go deeper into the muck, new things keep popping up all the time. So, but it's really a case of trying to piece together and paint this web as clear as possible. You know, we know things like, you know, it is impossible for an audit company to audit the Gupta's empire for, what was it, 12 years and not know what the hell was going on. So things like KPMG were going to come up. You know, the wedding was a huge thing in the news in the first place. So you can kind of backtrack to that and sort of add more information to that. So from an editorial perspective, you know, the editors are involved on, you know, consultation all the time, talking about what the best use of resources, what are the biggest, hardest hitting ones we can go for first. And then it's just really a case of, you know, maintaining the will to live through all of this while you still keep going. You know, it's a terabyte of information. It's a lot of crap.
So how many news organizations at the moment actually have access to it?
At the moment, I think it's 5 news organizations. I think the process of making all this information available to other media houses has been completed, and you know, other media houses have been offered the opportunity to access that information, signing away whatever, I mean, signing the legal agreements to be able to access it and the risks that come with, you know, publishing this stuff.
Okay, and then from a legal point of view, is there any sort of legal ramifications involved, or is it all...
So at a very basic level, journalism that is published in the interest of the greater public good usually is the the principle that allows us to do what we do. But in this case as well, we're you know, 100% sure that the information wasn't obtained illegally, that, you know, there aren't any legal issues around that.
But I'm also assuming actually dragging this into a courtroom isn't exactly the brightest move, because it would lead to the data being...
Yeah, and more information being made available to prosecutors, for example.
Yeah, and the validity of the data also being either 100%, well, it already is, but you're now having a court say, no, this is definitely legitimate data.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when we got it in the beginning, we got a sample of the data. And the sample looked good. And when you look at the volume of data there, to be able to replicate...
It's just not practical for someone to try and spoof that amount of data. And it's already been corroborated by some MPs even.
No one has really come out and questioned the validity of the data. I think the line has been, you know, I haven't seen this, so I can't comment on it. it's
the usual.
It's
led to some interesting things about corporate involvement. And now also what's nice is you've got like the Signia CEO sort of holding KPMG sort of accountable to answer. Like she's using her position as using KPMG as an auditor and saying, you now need to actually answer these questions. Otherwise, I'm not going to use you anymore. So it's like, what do you think the role of corporate responsibility sort of is when it comes to these sorts of things?
Well, I think it's important for the public to realize that government corruption doesn't happen in a vacuum. It requires the private sector on the other side of the equation for that. You know, the bribes that are being paid to siphon money off from the state involve, private enterprises. Those private enterprises are audited, they're banked, they are subject to their own, you know, industry regulations. So
it's also interesting when you've got the international entities and now you've got different jurisdictions potentially getting involved in looking into the behavior of these international corporations.
Yeah, we can't rely on our local authorities to do that. So it's good that, you know, big multinationals are being pulled into this. It's good to see them taking some sort of action, which is great, because it also then shows how guilty the parties on the other side of the transaction look, even though they're not taking action on this side.
You know? Yeah, it's crazy.
So, it just proves how fraudulent and out of order those transactions were. I mean, when you're talking about billions of dollars. I mean, in the case of Transnet and SAP Systems, Transnet was identified as one of the 15 biggest accounts for SAP worldwide. I mean,
it's crazy.
That's mad. That's mad money when you're thinking of the size of SAP. So, it's good that the public realizes that, because it's also, you know, it's easy to kind of, you know, stand from afar and point to government corruption, government this, government that. It's corporates. Corporates that, you know, people you know, friends, some cases family, work for. You know, where the culture is all about greed, profit.
And I don't think they actually realize obviously some do, but I think some of them see it almost as just doing business.
And that's a problem. You know, so how can you sit here and complain about a corrupt government when, you know, the ethics in the business place aren't there to start with themselves?
And that's why so many people were so impressed with the CEO of Signia holding other corporates accountable and saying, I'm not going to give you my business if that's the way you're going to operate.
Yeah, and I think that's a step in the right direction. We can't just, you know, we need business to... business has been a big enabler of this crap that's gone down, either from participating or being silent with what's gone on. The stench around KPMG has been there for a long time. No one should have been working with them when the first stuff started coming out. I mean, and they've been involved not only in the Gupta scandals, but, you know, the SARS rogue unit scandal as well, the Net1 scandal. They pop up all over, you know, it didn't take a lot for people to go, well, we shouldn't be using them, you know, and in that way forcing their hand to take action against what could have been corrupt elements in their own organization, or if the culture was just, you know, too big, not using them at all, you know. But that's the kind of influence that business can yield, but hasn't yielded, you know. And that's, you know, they've enabled this to take place through their silence, and as I said, in some cases their participation. But then also in other cases, just being too afraid to speak out.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Being too afraid to speak out, being too afraid to support organizations that do speak out.
Yeah, but if it becomes so detrimental to be involved in any gray areas whatsoever because you risk losing 100 other clients, then that sort of will almost police itself to a degree. Because if it becomes so detrimental to be implicated in anything because you'll potentially lose other clients, I think at the end of the day, that would be the best sort of outcome. We could have more people coming forward like Signia and saying, if you operate like this, you're not getting our business at the end of the day.
Yeah, look, I mean, and in that space, they're a price, you know, they're a price maker. They don't, you know, they can, you know, they have a choice of other audit firms that they can go to. It's not like they're going to get a much better audit from KPMG or much better audit. Look, you're going to get an audit, right? I mean, it's not exactly like high end, you know, I guess. There are differences, and you know, there can be such a thing as a quality audit that's done in value adding audits. Of course, it can be, but it's, you know, it's very easy for them to give that business to someone else. It's not really going to hurt their business. Yeah. Question comes, you know, if that decision was going to hurt their bottom line, would they have been as vocal? You know, so for example, if they were a, you know, if they had SAP systems installed in their business all the way through, and now they had to change that.
Yeah, which apparently is an absolute nightmare.
Would they still do that? So it's easy to change auditors like this. That's no problem. It doesn't cost you anything. You know, but if, you know, if they say, well, we're not going to use SAP systems, we're going to rip this all out, and it's going to cost us 50 million rand to do that.
Yeah, then things change a little bit.
That's what I'd like to see. You know, you know, so it's a little bit of, you know, easy sort of, it's a lower hanging fruit on that side to be able to say we won't do it because it doesn't cost anything. It's when the real cost comes in. It's no, I will not pay this bribe to get this profitable contract.
It's
are the kinds of decisions that we need to see business making. Or yes, I will support this, you know, organization, you know, through whatever means I can, under the radar, whatever it is, because they're doing such a good job. I don't need to have my name alongside this. You know, there's those kinds of things. Those are the things that, those are the real impacts that you make. You know, changing auditors, not such a biggie.
Yeah. And then I'm keen to also just quickly, how did you approach security of the data? Are there any specifics there that you can share?
Yeah, so encryption was obviously in the early days when we started working on this, when it came out, when it was known that we had the data, or even before it was known that we had the data, the plan was to, and still is, I think the guys are all working on air-gapped computers. So the emails were loaded. So just loading, you know, 400,000 emails into a client that you can read and search the stuff is a nightmare. Just like trying to work it out, because, you know, some people's hard drives weren't big enough, because the initial amount of emails grew to double the size. So we're like, you know, we just bought all these, like, you know, new clean Macs to work on, you know. So they were air gapped. There were the drives were encrypted. We moved to a different location, so the I'm a B guys came to work at our office. Because
can you actually quickly, just for anyone who doesn't know what an air gap is, give a description?
Yeah, so it's a computer, in most cases a new one that has never been connected to the internet, that has a fresh installation of apps and software, so that in case someone, you know, if you were under surveillance in the past and someone had managed to get some rogue software onto your laptop, that it's not being compromised by loading all that data on that and then not connecting that new laptop to the internet.
So, yeah, because the air gap's usually like a description of a lack of connectivity.
Yeah, and it's really just never, air around the computer.
Guys go to extremes when it comes to creating air gaps between their physical computer and the outside world. So,
yeah. So the guys, all the investigators have been working on their own, carrying around a second laptop with, intense passwords and stuff. Where possible, we use as many Macs as possible with supposedly better encryption. We had a drill for if the Hawks raided the office, what we would do. We had to get extra security outside the door. We had lawyers on standby for any sort of urgent injunctions if we needed to get anything. So there was a threat of, and then also at the time was making sure that we were protecting the identity of the source. And that if anyone managed to get, hold of the data, they would be able to figure out who it was. So there were a whole lot of reasons why it needed to be air-gapped, although a lot of that is diminished now, I think.
But how did you approach, did you call, I'm actually curious, if I, for instance, found myself in that situation, who did you speak to, or who did you bring in, or just from a general knowledge sort of point of view, knowing about air gapping and was this just something sort of had to learn on the go, or
we did rely a lot on the I'm a Bungani guy's experience, and we talked about it, and the guys have been on investigative journalism conferences and digital security for journalists.
Okay.
And there's a lot of that stuff out there. It's a big concern. There are a couple of organizations that even in parallel to this, we're funding sort of pilot projects in giving separate, sort of Chromebooks with a clean, with a special installation of Chrome OS that basically shuts down and wipes the.
I think it's called the Black Book, if I recall correctly. Yeah, every time you start it up, it starts. Yeah. Fully fresh installation.
Fully fresh installation.
I think Edward Snowden and a few of them.
So we've got a pilot Chromebook that we've been working on, which is in parallel. So it's kind of the digital security is a huge thing, especially in this world of investigative journalism.
So I don't think you'd ever. It's quite rare to find yourself in that sort of situation, I guess. So.
Yeah, it is, but I think people will be, as more and more of these things happen, people will start taking, greater measures. Just looking at the emails that have come out now, you kind of think twice
about putting something in
writing.
I think there's a lot of CEOs and a lot of people out there probably all calling in teams saying, can this happen to us? What can we?
Yeah, the electronic shredder is probably being whipped out in a couple of places now.
And then just to finish off, looking at the future, how much more do you think is going to actually come from the leaks? Is there still smoking guns that could be found? How long is the roadmap ahead?
I'm feeling that we've done about 35 investigative pieces since we've started in 2 months. I think you just don't know. It's kind of like you're staring at this what are those? Remember those posters you used to
the dots,
the stuff would just fly out at you after a while, so I have a feeling it's going to be a little bit like that from here on in, that you'll be looking and then one day you'll find traces,
something that just links something up.
It's like mining for Bitcoin now, it gets you get the stuff in the beginning, it gets harder and more expensive, and there's less
a very good analogy actually.
Less ROI, but this is what the entire I'm a Bungani team, the Scorpio team, has been funded and founded to do this job. So as long as it's still relevant and we're still finding stuff to publish, the guys will work on that, and then it'll dissipate and, I guess other stuff will come up. We've got, some big occurrences happening in South Africa, and it's not like the world's going to stop being corrupt after this. you know.
Yeah, it's going to keep happening.
Yeah, it's going to keep happening, you know, hopefully not to the same level as the Guptas took it to in South Africa, which is actually quite extraordinary. If you think about it, if you look at the amount involved and the network and something like, you know, at last time I checked, it was 150 companies that were being used in this.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know. So, you know, that level, that scale is actually, it's impressive. I mean, it's like, this is, you know, you got to take your hats off to them in terms of like the masterminding that was required to put all this together.
A simple task.
I mean, they did like wash, rinse, and repeat the formula, which is, you know, access to government spend, create a company to service that spend or use their influence to get a commission for someone else's business with the state. And they just kept doing that over and over again and just keep building up a bigger and bigger pile of cash with impunity, you know, knowing that no one in South Africa at least is going to prosecute them. And yeah, so to answer that question of like how much from here, I guess also depends on whether anything actually happens to them.
You know, that's also very true. Yeah.
You know, if they're still here, still doing this stuff, then you know, the incentive to keep going and keep unearthing this is still going to be great. So,
do you think there's room? So you proved that there is this opportunity for data to be leaked and to sort of corroborate stories, implicate people. Do you think there's room? Okay, we've got WikiLeaks, which now puts the procedure in place for whistleblowers to leak information. I'm not sure how many South Africans would ever go to, say, a WikiLeaks. There have been incidents of that happening. Is there a way of putting a procedure in place so that whistleblowers do have a sort of easy sense that coming to you guys or coming to Amabungan or Scorpio is the best approach? Their safety is put first.
So, I mean, we are putting measures in place with our new website to be able for people to drop stuff, send through, you know, PGP encrypted messages.
Okay, that's amazing.
So we're catering for that. The challenge is that, you know, if the stuff ever does get to court, for example, then there's a problem because as a nation, we don't really take care of whistleblowers. You know, there's no like defense fund or there's no like, you know, I mean, we had to raise a relocation allowance, you know, for the source. A dude had to leave the country, you know, him and his family. And you don't just uproot and leave that easily, quickly, and cheaply. You know?
No, definitely not.
So we need to, you know, get some kind of fund established. And you know, only big business and wealthy South Africans can afford to fund that. But some kind of program that looks after whistleblowers and makes it easy for them to, you know, mount a defense, a legal defense that isn't going to bankrupt them and also put their lives in danger and also ruin their chances of working in a lot of sectors, you know. So
you're essentially giving up the life you've been living, especially when it's at this degree and this size. But
yeah,
I think one day if it ever becomes public, whoever it was will be held in the highest esteem because it's done in the interest of the public and it's done for the right reasons. You are sacrificing the life you've got for the better interest of
I think that will happen. I mean, with a bit of time between now and then, I think he will want his name to come out. And I think he will be celebrated. I think it was brave. I mean, it's put yourself...
Brave. Yeah, I've actually got goosebumps even talking about it.
He put his life on the line, he put his family's life on the line. He had to relocate. And then there was that, you know, month where the Sunday Times had started publishing and he was only due to leave a month later because our plans were that we were going to take 2 months to investigate all of this. But in that time, it got leaked to the Sunday Times. They published it. The stuff was out there, and he was still in the country with a high likelihood that they knew who had leaked the information. So there was a period of 3 to 4 weeks where
it's a scary time.
We were like, maybe this dude is, if we don't, you know, if his SMSs don't get responded to, that something could have happened. You know, it could have happened to him. We were like, fuck, this could happen. And then, you know, and there's a whole like crazy story, what was happening in the background that people don't know about, that we can't, you know, talk about yet. But there was, you know, that for us was the biggest thing. Well, obviously, being scooped was big and disappointing, but there was also this sense of like, fuck, this dude's walking around with a target on his back.
Put his safety above all else.
Yeah. And that was the thing that we were really like upset about.
But I think that's also why you will probably be the go-to for future leaks. I think it was quite clear you put the interest of the source above pretty much everything else.
Yeah, I mean, we had to make sure. I mean, you know, someone goes to that length of putting themselves out there, and you don't respect that, then, you know, like what, you know, then I wouldn't say we were just as bad as the other side, but I mean, it does, you know, it would, you know, like our ethics would be questionable if we did that. You know, we'd be putting our own greed ahead of the big picture here. Or our duty to the profession and to, you know, to people who participate in it.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, I think, is there anything else we might not have touched on? I think we've gone quite in depth there.
Yeah,
it's definitely a very fascinating point in, I don't know, it's almost the history of the media in South Africa. I think there will likely be books, documentaries, movies.
Yeah, there's two documentaries that I think are being pitched now. You know, that, you know, our own team here is working on one. We've had external sources. So I know the guys from who did Miner Shut Down are also pitching do a documentary around this, which is great because, I mean, from a personal brand perspective, not my personal brand, from Daily Maverick brand perspective, that's great. But also, I mean, the profession of good journalism, investigative journalism, if it gets out there, and also what goes on behind the scenes. You know?
It's a very good point. I think it now shows sort of the excitement and the sort of,
the importance and the level.
Yeah, exactly. The change you can actually make to the country by reporting on these sorts of things.
Yeah, and what a society looks like with a weakened or non-existent fourth estate. You know, now we start going into the questions around greater media issues. You know, what does that look like? What does a world without good journalism look like? What does a world with BuzzFeed and, you know, and aggregated news site and fake news and, you know, where real journalism, you know, is on its, you know, on its last legs, you know, what does that world look like? And, you know, I think we've gone some way to show that if we continue down the same path that we're currently on, the trajectory that we're currently on, you know, where business will put all their spend into Facebook and Google. Well, Facebook and Google aren't going to do the shit that we've just done. You know, they're not going to be doing all this work with where there's, you know, no monetary return for what you're doing. You know, what kind of, like, how are we going to be able to still fulfill that role, you know, if it's not being funded properly? That stuff doesn't come cheap. This, you know, investigations take ages, take skilled people, and you generally end up getting sued, you know, or like worrying for your safety. And all that stuff comes with a cost. So it takes us down that road, and luckily it highlights us at a critical time to say, should we've actually got to do something different here? You know, we can't just, you know, and it keeps coming back to business, you know, the mentality, the approach, the worldview that business and corporate South Africa especially has is that we just can't continue doing what we're doing here and expect all this stuff just to happen by itself. We can't expect people to say, oh, sorry, we can't support you because you're too political.
Or, yeah, I mean,
in case you haven't noticed, we live in a very political country.
Exactly.
Support has to come one way or another, whether it's direct or indirect. It has to come because in the absence of that, you know, this stuff is going to... We can see the on the ground effects of this corruption. We can see, and then here in Cape Town, you can see the booms on the state of the rail system in Cape Town is a complete fuck show because it's run by the National Prasa organization and booms for at level crossings are broken.
Yeah.
And people are driving through and trains are coming. Three cars have been hit in Newsburg. You know, you're seeing service delivery because, you know, sewage treatment plants. Less than 10% of the sewage treatment plants in South Africa currently work. You know, but you know the trains are fucked. You know, the rolling blackouts we used to have with Eskom. All these things are a function of the real consequences of this corruption that take place. And as a society, as a corporate sector, you know, we've got to change the way that we engage. And yes, investigative journalism for the state stuff is one element of it, but there's civil society that needs support. There's frontline organizations. You do a lot of great work, you know, trying to either expose the corruption or trying to force government into action. And those guys just don't get any support.
Yeah, and media accountability has been pivotal in holding back. I mean, it would be, without it, it would be pretty much the floodgates would be open. I mean,
you know, we're now getting to sort of like crazy shit is happening. I mean, example that has just popped up recently. There's a digital news publication in Zimbabwe, and I know the guy. And running for about 5 years, and he does it sort of like millennial reporting kind of stuff. So not really the Daily Maverick kind of stuff, but, you know, enough to be a good sort of, you know, a decent outlet, right? But, you know, generating revenue is so difficult that he's resorted to running a fake news site in South Africa. Okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That has almost as much traffic as Daily Maverick. Okay. That generates revenue for him to run his real news site in Zimbabwe.
Wow.
Okay. So now this is how fucked up the media is, that, you know, guys are trying to run a legitimate organization are running, you know, baboon has sex with gay man kind of stories to generate money from AdWords, AdSense to fund his real news organization.
Yeah.
So like that's the kind of like, do we, like, this is where we are. We need to take a long, hard look at this. And that's why, you know, we do things like having media gathering and, you know, as an education, and why, as an education element, saying, guys, we need to take a long, hard look. We need to fix it. We can't do this by ourselves. We can't fight on the budgets that we have. You can't expect us to be the front line without any other support where, you know, an ANN7 and a New Age gets, you know, more than 250 million rand.
Yeah, that's the thing.
In government advertising.
It shows just it's like you said, it shows just how fucked the system is.
You go to other big media outlets all scrambling for survival, but we're like, if you play the game, article will generate more revenue than, like, you know.
Yeah, it's like, it's, if you play the game according to sort of the rule book of sorts, then everything's fine and dandy. But the second you sort of go against the grain and do a more ethical, sort of honest approach to things, then it suddenly becomes almost impossible to stay alive.
Well, that's what we've been feeling like. You know, the playing fields have not been, you know, for us at least, haven't been level for a long time. Yeah. And we've been sort of playing against every challenge and hurdle you can think of, you know, whether it's the global deterioration of the business news model, whether it's Google and Facebook. I mean, our competitors are Google and Facebook. Yeah. How would you like that for a business, right? And then on top of that, you have the, you know, big media in South Africa that wants us to die. Then you have, you know, businesses that won't support you because you're too political. And you're kind of going, well, hang on a second. If we go where the money is, and then we'd be writing Justin Bieber articles and, you know, and fake news articles. And, you know, but you don't want to do that because if we don't do it, then who the hell is going to do it?
Yeah, it's a tough situation to be in. But, I mean, you guys seem to be turning things around. Well, not turning things around. That's a bad choice of words. But, I mean, things seem to be sort of gaining momentum and
yeah,
you definitely seem to be going in the right direction.
Yeah, the brand is growing. The traffic is growing. Revenue is growing. Not fast enough, but, you know. And you just got to believe that, you know, people will come around to the idea that, you know, a news or media organization that is built on the original fundamental principles of good ethical journalism can survive and prosper. But that's a big mountain to climb. But anyway, we've got our hiking boots on.
So thanks so much for listening. That was the Gupta Leak special, episode 3 of The Innovators, that with Steely Cheryl Lambis, and I'm Tom Kennedy, as you are well aware by now. You can find all the show notes, relevant info, and how to connect with me at The Innovators website, which is theinnovators.co, or on pretty much every social platform at TKennedySA. If you have anything awesome or any suggestions, ideas, or questions, please give me a shout. I'm always open to them. You can catch the next episode next week, which will be with Professor Timothy Noakes. We're going to be chatting about diet, nutrition, and a whole bunch of really amazing info from him as well. And then to make up for the lost time, I'm going to actually be releasing episode 5 shortly after the following week. So that'll be with Jonathan Shapiro, aka Zapiro, South Africa's famed cartoonist. And there's some amazing stuff about creativity and the history of South Africa in that one. So stay tuned, click subscribe, and yeah, I hope you enjoy listening to the show. Thanks so much. Peace.
Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes.
You're listening to the Innovators Podcast with Tom Kennedy, unpacking the stories of industry leaders in search of the tools, tips, and tricks that make them who they are today.